Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
The Stagwaddy game. Shall I go first?
Go first.
I've got a great category. Cracking category. Okay, this is, I was so pleased about this, Calypso singers. Okay.
Calypso artists. Lovely idea.
So here we go. Five Calypso artists, one of whom is a figment of my imagination.
One of whom will have the word plantain in his name.
Okay. Here we go. Mikey Sparrow.
Yep.
Lord Snooty. King Short Shirt. Red Plastic Bag. And Raz Shorty the First. Mikey Sparrow, Lord Snooty, King Short Shirt, Red Plastic Bag, Raz Shorty the First. Which one of those is a figment of my imagination?
Oh, that's brilliant. Red plastic bag is so absurd that it must be true. You couldn't possibly have made that. Mighty Sparrow, we all know. The mighty, mighty Sparrow. Lord Snooty, that's difficult. Red plastic bag. And what was the last one? Raz?
Raz Shorty the First.
Raz Shorty the First. He's a genius. That sounds like it might be possible. Dave, I'm going to go for Lord Snooty.
Oh, you bastard. You bastard, you're right. Yeah.
Oh, no.
All the other ones are real. Mikey Sparrow, the King Short Shirt.
That's fantastic.
The name is that.
That's such a good category.
Red plastic bag.
So there was a Calypso thing called Red Plastic Bag.
Yes.
How fabulously evocative is that? That's just genius. All right. Well, look, I'm going to hit you with lesser-known, hard-living, Thunderbird-drinking, late 20s and 30s bluesmen.
Oh, right. Okay.
All right. Okay. We got five of them. One of them's fictitious. We have Bumblebee Slim, Richard Hacksaw Harney, Catfish Lonnie McCoy, Peg Leg Howell, and Hambone Willie Newburn.
It's Hambone Willie Maybon, isn't it? Or is it? I don't know. Okay.
Oh, God, is it so?
The last two are real, definitely. Hambone Willie is real. And the one before that, what was the fourth one?
Peg Leg Howell
is real. So go from the beginning again.
Bumblebee Slim, Richard Hacksaw Harney, and Catfish Lonnie McCoy.
I'm going to say Bumblebee Slim.
Oh, no, that's real. That's true.
Oh, really?
No, that's true. There's no friend. No, Catfish Lonnie McCoy is the one I made up. The one I was going to try was Boneyard Jackson. But then I thought nobody would go out there calling themselves Boneyard Jackson because it doesn't sound terribly attractive, really.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Oh, that's terrible if I got a real one wrong.
No,
I could have done.
Maybe you didn't. Oh, that's very good.
It's possible.
So you responded to my gentle recommendation. I want to talk about gentle recommendations of Call My Agent. And you watched Call My Agent last night, didn't you?
Well, yeah, we watched two episodes. I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
It's really good, isn't it?
I could not recommend it more highly.
No,
the basic structure of it is it's a bit like Mad Men. You're introduced to this office. It's like Mad Men, but in the world of the kind of theatrical agent, isn't it? Film agents, they're representing actors. And it starts with, and so you've got this wonderful combination of people. You've got the slightly catty gay girl in her late 30s as a sort of camp junior agent. There's two guys who are warring constantly to steal contracts off each other. All manner of brilliant intrigue. It's so funny. And the opening plot is about an actress called Cécile de France. And you can see how plausible this is. She's offered a part they put her up for a Tarantino film. And the Tarantino people eventually come back after she's given an interview saying she's doing this film, come back and say she's too old.
Yeah.
And so you get all the repercussions of how do they tell her and what does she do about it? And, you know, the things she's required to do. Does she have to have plastic surgery? And, oh, it's just fantastic.
So the key thing to know about this is obviously French. And it's set within the French film industry. And so every episode features a real French actor.
That's right.
Playing themselves.
So you get Isabelle Huppert. Later.
Yeah. And so you get this really interesting thing going on between, you've got actors playing parts, and then you've got alongside actors playing themselves. And so you get a very interesting kind of dynamic between the two, you know. I think it's, but what interested me about it, and the reason I wanted to mention it in the podcast, was I started watching it in response to a gentle recommendation from Jim Irvin, you know,
had on the podcast, yeah.
And Jim just on Twitter said, I've been watching Call My Agent, and it's just really nice and really sexy and kind of funny. And he just did it quite gently. I thought, oh, I might watch that, because I don't respond to people's vigorous recommendation. I don't respond to kind of people thumping the table saying, you've got to watch this, you know.
And it's hard to respond to people who are film critics or whatever, because that's their job. They've got to find something every week to get excited.
Whereas when Jim said this, I thought, oh, Jim doesn't do that often. Okay, fine, I'll watch it. And I watched it and I just really enjoyed it. And what I've said to people, like I said to you, is you might like this, you know, which is what I said to people, you know, anybody listening to this or watching this podcast now, you might like this. You might not. You know, it's not like Breaking Bad or whatever. You've got to watch it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm fearful of those people who go around with kind of missionary glint in their eye, trying to force you to watch a television program.
Completely.
Which is probably going to take up 48 hours of your life, and at the end of which, you're going to think, why did I do that? But anyway, you might like it. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Now, I recommended it to
terrific.
A couple of my daughters started watching it. They like it as well.
It's so funny. Also, it has that wonderfully absurd sense of, you know, a very key figure dies in the first episode. He's the head of the agency. And he dies after swallowing a wasp. And I love those kind of things. You know, it's just so...
Perfect. Perfect.
So daft, you know. So comic.
Talking about films, I note that the James Bond film has been put back. I don't know when they're in possibly Easter weekend in next year. You know,
which it's been put back twice, hasn't it? Because wasn't it coming out and originally? Well, it was the time before lockdown. I think there was the time during lockdown, wasn't it? Isn't that right?
Probably. So you know. There's probably no guarantee that it comes out of the Easter next year, you know. And there's, you know, there's a story in the news today that is it Cineworld, the chain of kind of major multiplexes, is shutting down, you know.
Yeah.
Because they just can't guarantee people are going to come, you know. It's obviously very, very serious news for anybody whose job's involved. And so forth, but it kind of makes you think about the film industry, you know, because it's like our recent discussions about, you know, when's Glastonbury coming back, or, you know, major tours and so forth, because ever since, you know, it seems in the last 20 years, everything has proceeded on a kind of 2-year plan, hasn't it? You know what I mean? We'll do this for 6 months, and then we'll do that for 6 months.
Absolutely.
And then there'll be a tour here, or there'll be a promotion here, and so forth. And everything's very scientific. Everything's meant to perfectly dovetail, isn't it? And all coordinate. Everybody's coming from, you know, different angles, but it's all supposed to coordinate. And, of course, recent events have just, you know, put a bomb under that, haven't they, really? You just can't do that anymore.
Don't you feel that film stars are sort of invisible? Unless you see film stars actually out meeting their public, they sort of slightly cease to exist.
They do.
The importance of premieres is absolutely crucial. Well, because even though it's only a brief thing, they're there and they're real and they're pressing the flesh.
I think one of the victims of this, although this has probably been going on a while, is the film star. Because, you know, the kind of deal with the film star, and you take the kind of classic one, Tom Cruise, you know, that he made big films, and half of the money in the film went to him. And the reason half of the money went to him is that Tom Cruise could open a film.
Yeah. You
know, and it was all about the opening weekend. It was all about the fuss. It was all about the coordinated premieres. It was all about the takeovers of radio stations and television channels and everybody getting their little 5 minutes of Tom Cruise or whatever, and all about the red carpet and all about the newspapers, all just building up to this massive hype round one weekend, all designed to drive people to feel that they had to go, that they had to go this weekend to see the film. And if it didn't open big, it would never get big later on.
That's right.
You didn't have a sleeper film at all.
No, no, it was all based on that foundation, wasn't it?
It was all in the
opening
weekend.
And the perception that it was a success. Once the press put out the fact that it opened huge, that it was already a certified...
It was absolutely
fine.
You've
got to go and see it, yeah.
And that's how things have gone for the last 20, 30 years, I suppose. And it's clearly not going to be like that anymore, is it? Because if you can't rely on an opening weekend, you know, on knowing when the opening weekend is going to be, you're going to do things in a different way. So in the world of streaming, they just put things out, don't they?
Yeah.
You probably haven't seen it, and I haven't seen it, but I know it's a big success. I was just reading about it this morning. The Tiger King, which is this documentary real-life thing about, I don't know, exotic animals and death and so forth in some zoo in America. I don't know, and I don't care. I've seen it,
yeah.
You've seen it, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point being, within 11 days of it being put out on March the 20th, it had been seen 45 million times, okay? Now, you've got to do a lot, you know, your Tom Cruise world, to equal that, you know.
And you in the have, case that's where, a rare example of something benefiting from lockdown, because that was the time when everyone was suddenly at home and everyone was saying, you must watch this. So the entire world watched it.
But there was no advertising. There was no hype.
No,
it
no.
wasn't. It wasn't on the Graham Norton show or any of that kind of stuff, you know.
No.
So, you know, it strikes me film stars, you know, they are rooted in a world which has just gone away. You know, stars, not actors. Actors are a different thing. But stars, and I don't know if those big paydays are coming back.
They may not.
Bad news, Mr. Cruise.
No, it is.
But I'm sure he's putting away in quite enough money anyway.
We've had exactly the same conversations about the rock music world, haven't we?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
About the concept of a rock star when they don't physically exist and you can't physically see them.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, because the other thing that's the other trend that's been running in parallel with this is, and I'm aware it's a world that you and I know nothing about, which is the kind of world of kind of action films featuring people generally, you know, as the old joke goes, wearing their underpants out over the top of their tights. and the kind of the Marvel world, the comic book heroes and so forth, which is, as far as I can tell, responsible for a huge amount of cinema seats sold all over the world. And the only person I know who's caught up with this world, who knows about this world, should be out there right now. Alexander Gold, are you with us?
Hello.
Mr. Magic Ace.
Paul Alex.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, hello.
We can hear him. Producer.
We can hear him. We can't see him.
There
but
he
anyway,
is.
Oh, there. We can even see you. That's perfect.
Alex, lovely to see you. We need your help here.
We need your input.
We're too old.
Because Mark and I, you know, during lockdown, we've been reading improving books and so forth and learning how to crochet. You haven't been doing that at all. You've been catching up on Marvel films,
I've been
haven't you?
People wearing their pants outside their trousers en masse, yeah. And it's been great.
So you started on these films, didn't you, during lockdown?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously with the world on hold and, you know, not touring or going anywhere, you're kind of looking for stuff to do. And the Marvel world has actually passed me by for the past 10 years. I haven't seen any of it. And I'm probably the only one in my little circle who hasn't seen any of it. And I discovered there are 23 of these films. So I decided in the month of June...
So give us some names of the 23 of these films. Go on. What sort of names?
So it kind of centres around sort of the big six. So you've got... you've got Captain America, you've got Spider-Man, you've got the Hulk, you've got Thor, you've got Black Widow, Hawkeye, and there are more, Ant-Man.
Complete blank day for us, isn't it? I do remember reading Marvel Comics in the late 70s briefly, but this is just, no, I've never seen one of these.
So I decided that there are okay, so we've got 10 years worth of Marvel oeuvre now, because they've been putting out content like the clappers since the studio started. And so I spent the month of June watching all 23 movies in order of release.
Good God.
And I can't imagine them not being in my life anymore. I'm completely obsessed with the whole universe now. And the other day, I decided that I wanted to delve deeper, because there are all sorts of spin-off series and, you know, stuff between the cracks, basically. So there are numerous ways you can watch the Marvel output, and order of release is but one. And another way to do it is in absolute chronological order. So I decided to look up online how I could possibly watch all of the Marvel output, major and minor. So we're talking films, series, shorts, all that kind of stuff, in the chronological order as presented in the Marvel Universe. So you're starting with Captain America, which is set predominantly in World War II, and you finish with Avengers Endgame, which is set in 2023. Actually, I think there's a little bit of a series beyond that. There are 71 different things to watch.
71 films. So if you start, you can watch them all week, couldn't you, without pause?
Well, I'm doing a little bit each night. I started again last night, actually. I started Captain
America. Started again.
Yeah, yeah. But it's fascinating, because you go back and you notice things, little Easter eggs that are plonked throughout the movies that you didn't notice first time around. You know, there's layers. It's like an onion, like an onion full of it.
So, am I right in saying that the names of the actors and these things don't really matter? What really matters is the character.
They've got really big hitters in each film. So you've got Hugo Weaving, Robert Downey Jr., Scarlett Johansson. Oh, God.
But that's not what makes people watch them, is it?
Well,
Ant-Woman or whoever
it is. Yeah, it can't matter who's playing that.
Even an Ant-Man is probably what you consider a sort of minor, you know, part of the universe. Michael Douglas is in those films. So they've got a big hitter in each film.
No, I'm not saying they haven't got them, but nobody's going, oh, I'm a Michael Douglas fan, I'm going to watch Ant-Man. It's not happening.
You know, the weird thing is, it's almost incidental. Yet they're there.
Yeah, yeah, like, surely you're saying Ant-Man is now suddenly played by so-and-so. That's interesting.
You know, you watch the Thor movies and you're, oh, Jeff Goldblum's in it. Wow, okay. It's kind of almost an afterthought. But I suppose that's indicative of the changing dynamic of the movie industry, I suppose, isn't it?
Oh, well, it definitely is. And also the huge fact, that these things play as well in China as they play in the UK or the USA, you know, because language just doesn't matter at all. Because it's... Yeah.
Everybody understands flying and explosions. Yeah, that's the thing. But the awful thing is, after watching Avengers Endgame, which is so epic, and on it, after watching one a night for 23 nights, you're really geared up for this finale. Do you know what I mean? Everything in your life so far has been leading up to this 3 hours of film. And once you finish watching it, you can't watch anything for about a week, because just nothing. There doesn't seem any point in watching anything else.
Is that the last one?
Yeah.
So that it has officially ended.
It just feels like the absolute pinnacle of all filmmaking since time began. Like, once you finish it, you're like, I can't. I didn't know. There's.
So I've only got one question,
yeah.
Mark.
Yeah.
Mark, are you tempted?
Not even remotely. We used to have that thing in the Word office, didn't we, between people who liked science fiction and people who didn't, and the people who didn't would always go, "It's not real. They're not real." Doesn't matter. No, not really.
It's like Danny Baker says about fiction. I don't like it because it's all made up.
It's all made up, exactly.
Yeah. No, I think the thing with the Marvel thing, for me, I've been watching a lot of sci-fi since lockdown began.
Be careful, Alex. You don't get that messianic glint in your eye when you try and recommend it, you know, because we'll turn off. But go on, carry on.
I think it's perfect for times like these because, you know, I think more than ever, we kind of need a place to escape to, you know, with the world as it is.
Yeah.
And something that's so vast in its scope and scale in terms of what it presents to you. It's kind of the Marvel Universe is the perfect escape for a world that's gone mad and stopped.
Well, listeners, we have not been paid for this endorsement.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
We were talking last week about whether there's any need for these... endless lists of the greatest albums ever made, and you know, things you have to listen to before you die, those key those key words that they always include nowadays. And we were discussing, you know, when this was invented, this whole idea of the kind of the rock canon and retrospective lists. And you said you thought there'd been...
Well, I thought it was late 70s that the NME had done one. But in fact, well, it's earlier, isn't it? Because somebody very kindly, one of our viewers, has sent us...
Yes, Ed Barrett sent this. He's actually much-loved, pre-loved copy of the NME from June the 1st, 1974, with their list of... it was a fold-out in the middle, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I've got it here, yeah.
In 100 all-time greats. And it's kind of, it's pretty much the obvious stuff, isn't it, in many cases. You know, Sgt. Pepper's at number one, Blonde on Blonde, number two, Pet Sounds, Revolver, Highway 61, two Jimi Hendrix records, Abbey Road, Sticky Fingers,
Music, Big Pink.
Yeah. So all that. But what's interesting is, the odd inclusions that you clearly wouldn't find anywhere near any kind of all-time albums list nowadays. I noticed that families...
And things that are missing, too.
But it's got at number 44, just above Stevie Wonder's Talking Book, you got Family's Music in a Doll's House.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's gonna be on any list, subsequently. You got Stephen Stills' first solo album. You got Johnny Winter and number 71. Well above the Who's Next and Sly and the Family Stone, there's a riot going on.
Stand Up by Jethro Tull, which is unbelievable, Marilyn. Not a bad record, but I mean, the idea that it's in the top 100, you know. And there's some that are kind of still fashionable. There's King Crimson's In the Court of the Crimson King, an observation by King Crimson, as Danny Baker always used to correct us, which is still at 37. And that's still kind of fashionable, isn't it? As is Hot Rats by Zappa. But Traffic's Traffic album, probably gone out of vogue. Love Forever Changes.
Nobody talks about that anymore.
Out of vogue. I think that's probably... I mean, Spirits, The 12 Dreams of Dr. Sardonicus is in the top 100, which is absolutely astonishing.
It's 98.
And Country Joe and the Fish, 98. Country Joe and the Fish, Electric Music for the Mind and Body at number 81. That is the 81st best record ever made at the time. It's astonishing, really, isn't it?
I suppose so. And also, have you noticed what's in number 40? You may not be able to scroll through your list. Number 40 is an old favourite of yours. It's one rank below the Beatles' White Album and just above Frank Zappa's Hot Rats is the first Soft Machine album.
Oh, yeah, so it is.
Number 40.
That is wrong, isn't it? very wrong.
But what's the record that's not anywhere on the top 100? And this is only 3 years after it came out. So you would have thought it would still be reverberating around the world three years.
What's going on by Marvin Gaye? I know, if that was the greatest record ever made, then why 3 years after it came out or whatever? I know. It's the same. Actually, another interesting example of that is Blue by Joni Mitchell. Blue by Joni Mitchell is number 67.
Oh, right. Yes.
And you think that'd been out for 3 years. So the full impact of that. I can understand Dark Side of the Moon being 92 because it only just come out. It actually came out about 6 months before this chart was made.
Oh, right. That's true.
Yeah. So maybe people hadn't quite got around to working out its value. But yeah. Blue by Joni Mitchell, number 67, because that's now in the top three, isn't it? I think in the recent Rolling Stone chart.
Yeah, I think it was number two, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, yes. But it is really odd to look at this. The top 10, you have Jimi Hendrix, Electric Ladyland at number six. Well, they wouldn't even show the cover nowadays. You know?
I know.
And Are You Experienced at number seven? I don't think either of them are in the top 10 albums ever made, either then or now, you know, really. But.
And I don't think there's any Led Zeppelin, is there? Which is a very rock critic thing, because rock critics generally...
Oh, yes, there is. There is.
Is the one? Oh, there is.
Number Led Zeppelin 4 is at 35.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Just between Every Picture Tells a Story and the first Doors album. But anyway, we're very grateful for Ed for sending that. He also sent... He'd found a singles one, didn't he? Let me see if I can find that.
Yes.
Have you got it there?
I've got it somewhere here, yeah.
Because this
the singles, the top 10 singles is 1976. The top 10 were like a Rolling Stone. Strawberry Fields, number two. River Deep, Mountain High, three. I Get Around by the Beach Boys, number four. What an odd choice that is. I mean, Beach Boys, yes, obviously. But in fact, Good Vibrations is number 8, so it's fair enough. My Generation, number 5. I Heard It Through the Grapevine, 6. Satisfaction, 7. Good Vibrations, Tracks of My Tears, and Dancing in the Street. That's the top 10. But it's interesting. And also, Bob Dylan being number 1. Bob Dylan isn't really a singles act, is he?
Well, I don't know. It's just
general reverence for Bob Dylan, I think.
There's lots
of soul in there. There's Otis Redding and Aretha Franklin and the Drifters. And there's some, I suppose, what we call heritage now. There is some stuff from the 50s, isn't there? Buddy Holly, That'll Be the Day. And Mr.
But is there a David Bowie single in there?
No, there's no David Bowie.
I felt as if they were...
No T-Rex.
There's hardly anything from the 70s, I felt, until I got to number 60. And then they got Walk on the Wild Side by Lou Reed. It's as if they couldn't think of the decade in which they were doing it. They had to, you know, go back to the 60s or the 50s.
Extraordinary, I just noted something here, Cold Turkey is in there. That's an extraordinary thing. That's just to do with, again, with the level of reverence for John Lennon. Cold Turkey is a great single. It's just nonsense. Clean Up Woman by Betty Wright. Something in the Air by Thunderclap Newman. That's extraordinary.
Oh, it's a good record.
It's a good record, but I mean, you know, that's kind of fizzled out slightly, isn't it?
It has. Yeah, it doesn't have there's no enduring cult, is there?
The one that really exercised me was You Keep Me Hanging On by Vanilla Fudge. Now, I'm not disputing that's a good version of that song, but the idea that that's there and the original version isn't is astonishing. Also, that's true. Vanilla Fudge's version, but it's very rock critic.
That is very rock critic. I can remember Vanilla Fudge used to be the thing most played on the college jukebox in 71, 72. Because the reason people always used to get it on the jukebox was it was about 6 minutes long.
So you got quite
a lot of value for your tanner or whatever it
was.
So you're talking about John Lennon there, and so it's 80 years.
Yep.
John Lennon's birth, which I wrote a thing for the Radio Times about it, and
so he's been as dead. He's been dead
as long as he was alive.
As long as he's alive, I know.
It was terrible.
It's appalling.
I tell you what I was thinking about him. Struck me when I was rooting round looking at stuff. I was watching an interview with done, I suppose, a couple of years after he died, with Aunt Mimi.
Oh yeah,
the woman who brought him up, his aunt, and he installed her in a bungalow down on Sandbank.
So Sandbank's ferry. It was a great picture of him with her coming off the ferry.
Yeah, and she was clearly a kind of a bit of a remarkable personality. But I couldn't get over the fact that even when he left Britain in 1971 and he never came back. But he obviously kept in touch, you know, a lot. He wanted to know what was happening in Britain. But he used to ring her every week.
Right up until he died, wasn't it?
Right up until he died.
Yeah.
And if you watch the interview with this woman, she's clearly quite a remarkable woman. But you could tell, you can find this interview on YouTube. It was done by Southern TV or something like that. It's just they go to her house.
I've seen it.
And she clearly, we've probably all had elderly aunts in our families who've all gone to meet their reward now, so we can say this. They were all at one time or another a bit much. Yes? Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In every family, there will be a couple of elderly aunts who can be a bit much, and sort of like to hear the sound of their own voice. Hey, we saved this in the middle of a podcast. That's rich. But anyway, she was clearly one of those. You can tell that from that interview. You know, she's always kind of quoting herself in the interview, and And obviously John Lennon was doing the right thing by keeping in touch with her, and she meant an awful lot to her, and he was very you know, grateful for what she'd done for him, and that's absolutely right. But my God, she must have been a bit difficult every week. You know, did you, you know, when you when our late mothers were alive, did we ring them every week dutifully? I'm not sure we did.
I don't think we did, no. And obviously, if you think how the cultural difference alone is that he was living in the Dakota building and his life in New York would have been something that she could never have pictured, never imagined. She would never really have understood the nature of American culture. And he would have found it very hard and probably slightly nostalgic, actually, to hear about life down in you know, near Bournemouth. But, I mean, you can imagine there must have been so little kind of connection. But it obviously meant a lot to him, didn't it?
But I think also, I wonder, whether playing the amateur analyst here, whether he, throughout his life, he really wanted stern female presences. And Yoko was one of those. Do you know what I mean? That he liked to be told what to do.
Cynthia, too.
There you go.
Cynthia, who I think was older than him, wasn't she?
She was.
And kind of organised him and bossed him around and told him what to do. And, you know, and he needed that. Mother figures, a major, major thing. Didn't he call Yoko mother?
He did.
Didn't he refer to her as mother?
God, he did, didn't he? I hadn't thought that.
Yeah, he did.
And, you just thought, you watch the interview with Mimi and you think, if John got on the phone every week for an hour, she would have been talking for most of that hour. She just would.
Yeah.
And his job would have been to say, yes, you're probably right. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way or whatever. You know, it would have been slightly in the, he would be ticked off for the best part of an hour. And he volunteered for that every week.
For it once a week. I know. He took it on an Australian tour in, I think, 65, didn't he? And if you look on YouTube, I think there's footage of her being interviewed on an aeroplane. I'm fairly sure.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
I always thought that was amazing because, you know, the idea that anybody is embarrassed about having, for example, their own parents in the audience, you know, if they're a musician, and how you would feel about that. But the idea that Aunt Mimi, who was so kind of... prim and strict and rigid to some extent, wasn't she? And obviously critical of what he was doing in the early days. The idea that he invited her out on that tour to sit in his audience as they played Australia.
Because clearly part of her performance always when he was there was to say, in front of the largest crowd she could find, I told John not to do that. I've always told him if he does that, not to come here and all that kind of stuff. And he volunteered for that because he liked it. Because it made him feel he was at home. You know, it's a really profound thing in his life, I suppose.
It
is. Because he, for a certain time, his early days, early years were very uncertain.
Yeah.
And, in fact, most of his life was fairly uncertain, I suppose. So what for you is the key John Lennon musical moment? If you got to pick one.
Oh, God, musical moment. Gosh. In my life, No Reply, Help. This Boy, Mr. Kite. God,
that's enough.
I don't know. I mean, they had extraordinary warmth and humour and humanity, didn't they? I'm afraid to say, and I've said this on podcast, pass him, that I felt he lost a lot of that when he no longer had as his core team George and Paul and Ringo, and it was mainly Yoko and a few session musicians. And I think some of that warmth and wit went out of his music. I don't know. That's just me, really. But what about you? Best moment? God, that's
No Reply, definitely. But yeah. I've got great affection because I have great affection for the for its use in the movie Hard Day's Night. Is If I Fell?
Oh, it's fantastic.
Which is just wonderful.
Yeah,
and gives the lie to the idea that John only ever wrote the kind of political abrasive stuff and Paul only ever wrote the sappy stuff, you know.
Yeah, completely.
Simply not true. But anyway, thinking of him on his 80th and what would have been his 80th birthday.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Okay. Any other business? A few things further to our recent excellent chat with Gerard Mankiewicz, the legendary photographer. And if anybody hasn't caught up with that, they really should do it in one of our...
Yeah, it was really good.
Word of Your Attic series. Gerard was telling us about his studio that he used to have in Ormond Yard in St. James's, where he took pictures of the Stones and the Yardbirds and loads of people like that. And I walk through Almond Yard quite often because it's on the way out of the London Library, and it's just really, it's just anonymous kind of, it's the back entrance of various office buildings and so forth. But down there, for years, as I used to go past, the tiny little gents' hairdressers, tiny little place. They used to have a little wooden sign above it saying, Court Hairdresser, C-O-U-R-T, Court Hairdresser. And the idea that if a gentleman wanted a short back and sides in order to be presented at court, you know, that's the place to go. Well, I realised that this was the place that Paul Denoyer used to talk about years ago.
It was. Our old pal from Mojo and Q and Word stuff.
I know. So where do you get your haircut?
A man who has his own tailor, of course. So, you know, and his own club that he's a member of.
There you go. That's Paul. Yeah. He's very much into all that stuff. He said, I get this chap in St. James's, and he's getting on. He must be in his 80s or whatever, but he still keeps going. And then I realised that this is the place that Paul's talking about. Of course, recently it was gutted, that building, and I saw the Court Hairdresser sign chucked into a skip and so forth. And I mentioned this to Gerard after our chat, which is on Word in Your Attic. And he said, oh, that was Philip. He said Philip had been there cutting gentlemen's hair since 1949.
Oh, no, fantastic.
1949. Yeah. And he said he'd been there looking out on the occasions when Gerard was taking those iconic photographs of the Rolling Stones and the Yardbirds, Jimi Hendrix, all these people. So Philip had been there cutting hair since 1949, you know, end of the war, you know, through the swinging 60s, right up until probably a couple of years ago, cutting the hair of Paul Denoyer. That was extraordinary, isn't it?
If anyone's not seen that picture, just Google Gerard Mankiewicz and Yardbirds, and that picture comes up. It is amazing, isn't it?
It's fantastic.
The five of them standing in a row. It's got Jimmy Page, and it's got Jeff Beck in the lineup at the time, and Keith Relf in the middle. And between Keith Relf's legs, in the distance, you see the man in the bowler hat.
Yeah.
And a kind of 60s girl as well, and the guy on his way to work. It's just a brilliant moment, a 60s moment kind of captured.
It's a fantastic, you know, all, we're delighted with all our Word in Your Attic chats, but I think that's a particularly good one.
It is.
He talks about taking those legendary photographs of Marianne Faithfull in a pub in St. Martin's Lane. And at the point, neither of them was old enough to drink.
That's right. And the effect it has on all the other the people in the pub when Marianne Faithfull comes. Yeah. Age whatever she was, 17, I think.
17. They were both he and Marianne Faithfull.
I know, it's astonishing.
We're 17. Yeah. So we got more of those coming up. And have you been enjoying Dylan's
book? I have. It's extremely good.
It's Dylan's book, Sweet Dreams, the story of the New Romantics, which we're going to talk to him about on. We're doing that on Tuesday, aren't we, Alex?
Yeah.
That's one of our crowd casts.
Leave.
Say again?
7 p.m. on Tuesday.
7 p.m. And so if anybody's a Patreon supporter, they'll be able to be in the room, as we like to say.
And we've got your man, Rob Halford. Is it Tuesday after? I think so. Yeah,
Could be.
Cool. But Rob Halford of Judas Priest, extraordinary story. A book called Confess. I think he's on the Tuesday after, the 12th. Yeah.
And Rob will be joining us from where? Where is he? Arizona or something like
that?
Is that where he is? So I've been approaching Dylan's book like a kind of selection box. You can just kind of open up anywhere and you'll find some little bonbon of information which will stop you in your tracks. And the most recent thing I found was that Andrew Ridgeley, talking about that he and George Michael, when they were kind of unknown, you know, teenagers, whatever, they went to see Genesis at Earl's Court. I just thought that's the most wonderful.
That's fantastic. Unlikely. That you would never have expected.
You wouldn't have thought.
No,
that
no, that's
at
great.
All, at all. So, yeah.
I like the little moment where Nick Rhodes talks about his definition of success, of rapid success. He says it means that every time you go to a restaurant, you look a little bit further down the wine list.
Oh, right.
That was great. That's great. Well, and also a great moment, one of those brilliant moments where you talk about the kind of pivotal nature of music fashion, where Steve Strange is outside the Blitz Club and Mick Jagger arrives. Have you got to that bit? Mick Jagger arrives in a limo with a kind of chaperone minder. And they kind of get out to try and get into the Blitz Club. Mick Jagger's wearing trainers and stuff. And Steve Strange decides he won't let him in because he doesn't fit the criteria. He's not a creative-minded pioneer. And he's wearing trainers. So he's not allowed in. And this is a lovely idea that's out of nowhere. This 19-year-old boy from Carefilly has arrived, you know, with an extravagant blouse on, an eyeshadow, and a lot of velvet, and a wedge haircut. And he's become the arbiter of taste.
Yeah.
And he can turn, obviously, sees the publicity value in doing it. And then a week later, of course, lets David Bowie in. It's completely the opposite. He's going mental. Bowie walks through the water. They part like the Red Sea, you know, fawning acolytes. No, it's good stuff.
So, Alex, have we got any new Patreon supporters in the last few days?
We do indeed. We have the legendary Paul Marshall.
The legendary Paul Marshall, of course.
Following behind closely, Carl Magnus Palm, a gentleman of repute.
Right.
What a great name, Carl Magnus Palm. Carl
Magnus Palm.
I'm going to venture a guess that that's a name from overseas.
Yes, I think it's somewhere in Scandinavia. It's
right, okay.
It's rather Scandinavian. We have the rocking vicar, the mysterious rocker.
Oh, right, okay.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
James Topham, who is an annual patron, and a reminder that if you do subscribe annually, there is a 10%, 15% discount.
Right.
On the rates. And last but certainly not least, we have this spectacular Mr. Ian Lowes.
Well, welcome to
Very
all of
welcome
them.
Aboard.
Have we got anybody's birthdays coming up in the next few weeks that we're gonna mark by visiting them for a word in their own particular attic?
Yeah, this month I believe we've got three.
All right.
I forget the dates.
Oh, we are. You don't know. You don't.
No,
have to tell
but us. We do have three coming up, and you can also view Paul Cook's if you are a subscriber on Patreon.
And if you want to know more about it, it's just go to patreon.com/word in your ear.
So that is a massive, massive advantage of being a patron, isn't it? We come and do a special, individual word in your attic.
Yes, we come into your house without actually having us coming into your house.
That's right.
It's a win-win, really, isn't it? Just absolutely perfect. So I'll just leave you with this piece of news. That in order to keep the nation's spirits up, Gary Barlow's going on tour.
Finally.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.